Everybody take their seats. Before we get into the reports on recent activities, are there any suggestions to changes to or additions to the agenda or any other matters? Okay. We'll get right into the reports on recent activities. The Executive Committee met on January 23rd. I believe it's behind tab one. I'll highlight or touch on some of the issues that we discussed. Some of them will come up in other agenda items across the next 3 days. One of the issues that was brought to the attention of the Executive Committee was, now that we've gone to digital audio recordings of council meetings, it would be helpful for those that go back and listen to the record if the chairman, myself, or chairs of committees, when they recognize individuals to speak, use the first and last name so that the record can show who's speaking. It's not always clear who is speaking. We have several Johns and several Jims, and it can get confusing. We also discussed our policy on motions to reconsider and whether or not we should use a two-thirds majority to allow a motion to reconsider. After discussion at the executive committee level, we recommend keeping the current policy for simplicity and consistency with Robert's rules. Under Robert's rules, motions to reconsider require a simple majority and may be made only on the day of the motion to be reconsidered or the following day. It must be made by somebody on the prevailing side. The next issue we tackled was reimbursement for council training. As most of you know and have been through, we have a regional training program that when you're newly appointed to the council, you spend a day in the council office, one at the regional office, and I believe one down in the science center. The council reimburses you for your time and your expenses to go through that training. Under the new Magnuson Act, there's a requirement for a national level training. And because we're under budgetary constraints, we decided that the council would continue to reimburse council members for their time in the regional training session, but that we couldn't reimburse you for your time at the federal level for training on a daily basis. The service will cover your travel expenses. And that's a requirement of serving on the council. Another issue we discussed was approval by consensus. And another recommendation that the Executive Committee has is that the council should not use approval by consensus for fishery management actions or other significant decisions. Instead, the council should use approval by consensus for actions such as directing the staff or handling minor procedural issues like draft a letter, something of that nature. We then talked about how committees operate. We believe that committees should still be able to use consensus to speed deliberations at the committee level. However, to minimize possible confusion, committees should vote on important issues and recommendations that they're going to forward to the council. The next issue we tackle is advisory panels and the designation of the chair of the AP and the tasking of an AP. The recommendation of the executive committee was to keep the current policy, which is in our SOPs, of allowing the oversight committee chair to designate AP chairs. However, if the committee chair wants to delegate that decision to the AP and ask them to elect a chair, that's within the purview of the committee chairman. The next issue we addressed was the recent approval of multi-species advisory panel members. The multi-species committee forwarded two names to sit on the multi-species committee, multi-species AP, and the executive committee approved them. That's Jackie O'Dell and John Williamson to fill vacancies on the ground fish advisory panel. And it also directed the council staff to begin solicitation for the new round of advisory panel members, because the current three-year term expires in October for the ground fish advisory panel. We also talked about the recreational advisory panel, and the committee recommended that the recreational advisory panel should report to, it says here, Groundfish Committee rather than the council. But it was also recognized that the recreational advisory panel also may be tasked to work with other committees such as Whiting. However, it's important to note that all advisory panels may report their recommendations at council meetings, and therefore the RAP will not lose access to the council. That was a consideration or a concern from the recreational advisory panel. We talked about terms of reference for the sector omnibus amendment. I believe they're somewhere in our document or our binder. We'll touch on that later. Whiting's stock status and management. We recommend that the Pelagics Committee continue to focus on the development of the amendment, including limited access and a procedure for setting TACs with limited information. We also recommend that the Council consider any information that comes from the NIMS Working Group on data poor stocks, which we believe is going to meet this June. There's a list of stocks that, and maybe Pat will touch on this in her report, that are classified as data poor, and we're looking to develop a strategy on how to manage those. After that working group takes action, there may be recommendations that can be incorporated into this Whiting Amendment. There was discussion about the SBRM amendment, the Standardized Bycatch Reporting Methodology Amendment. The committee recommended the council consider a technical amendment to be added to the SBRM amendment that would allow set-asides to be used to fund observers in order to implement or improve the effectiveness of management measures in all council FMPs. We also discussed potential impacts of the LNG mitigation funding. The executive committee recommended that the multi-species committee should factor what effects this mitigation may have on measures in the development of Amendment 16, and also suggested that the multi-species committee should communicate with appropriate groups receiving mitigation funding. We talked about Magnus and Stevens reauthorization. Paul Howard's going to give a presentation on that later. We also talked about renewed SSC and SSAC membership. And after a discussion, the committee decided it needed more time to think about how to structure the role of the SSC and the SSAC to meet the new MSA requirements. And, of course, we talked about our budget. It's possible the council may face as much as a $330,000 cut in our budget in 07, which may require the council to cut back considerably on staff costs, council operations, and management priorities. We don't anticipate knowing whether or not we'll be level funded or take a cut until hopefully at earliest later this month. Any questions? Paul.
Mr. Chairman, a couple things. On the terms of reference from the omnibus sector amendment, I would suggest that the council members take a look and review those terms of reference. They're in the binder under enclosure 2, and that we discuss the tasking and terms of reference for the sector committee under other business on Thursday, and we approve those on Thursday under other business. In terms of the recreational advisory panel oversight and tasking, I would suggest that we have a quick motion that approves the recommendations of the executive committee to have the recreational advisory panel report to the oversight committee as opposed to reporting to the council chair. That would be consistent with all our other APs. And in terms of the SBRM observer coverage, asking for a technical amendment about tax set-asides, I suggest that we may need a motion and discuss that under the SBRM agenda.
Okay. Anyone wish to make a motion concerning the Recreational Advisory Panel recommendation out of the Executive Committee? John Nelson. Is there a second? Seconded by Rodney Avila. Tom Hill? Okay. Any discussion? All those in favor, raise your hand. Opposed? Okay, motion passes. Okay, we'll move on to the Executive Director report. Phil.
Yeah, I got confused there. Did you need a motion to talk to move this SBRM observer coverage today?
We were going to take that up tomorrow morning at 8:30 under that agenda item.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple things real quickly. Many of you know Chad Demarest. Chad has been working for council staff and for the council for the last 5 or 6 years under contract mostly. With our budget problems, and I only was able to put him on a 6-month contract for this year, and we agreed we could each break the contract if the other found a job or if we didn't have the money. But we agreed that Chad broke the contract, that he was working for Ground Fish Amendment 13, and he's no longer with us. He's taken a job with Massachusetts Fisheries Institute. So we've agreeably, broken off with that contract. So you won't be seeing Chad, and he's going to be here today. So if you want to wish him well, he did a lot of great work for us over the last 5 years. In terms of budget, we may be in deep kimchi. If we're level funded, which all indications are we will be level funded, and that will be 7 years in a row that we've been eating cost of living, and it just doesn't 7 times 3% that we'd be down 21%. It compounds over the years. Now, over these last several years of being level funded, Bill Hogarth has been very good to us, giving us supplemental funds, NEPA funding, regulatory streamline funding, coral reef protection money to help us through recognizing our shortfall. And that money over the years has been roughly about 300-something thousand a year. If we do, all indications are we will be level funded, and that extra money, that supplemental soft money, may not be available to us. And if it isn't, we've already developed a plan with the executive committee and the council chair that in all likelihood we'd have to reduce staff, reduce council meetings. The last 4 meetings would be 2-day meetings instead of 3, and any number of things, reduce our priorities, and lose staff. So it's very serious to lose $300-something thousand. So we're in a time when we're trying to implement a new Magnuson-Stevens Act, we find ourselves woefully wanting for additional funds. And last thing, Mr. Chairman, I got a brief email yesterday from Mr. Bob Higgins. I don't know if you know Bob Higgins. He worked for the Coast Guard for, I think, the last 15 years doing fishing vessel safety, and he asked me to say goodbye to everyone. He took a job with an outfit down in Florida, not having anything to do with fishing vessel safety or the Coast Guard. A nice promotion, a good job working on submarines, recreational, commercial-type submarines that he's got a background in. So he's very excited to move down to Florida. He's bought a new van, and he's towing his Harley, and he wanted me to say goodbye to everyone. That's all I have, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions about Bob's Harley? Okay. Any questions for Paul? Pat?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I think most of you are aware that on December 22nd, we, at the request of the council and the industry, we did implement an emergency action in the scallop fishery to delay the opening of the elephant trunk access area, reduce the number of trips, and prohibit deck loading. A summary on the Days at Sea leasing program in the multi-species fishery. This is from May 1, 2006 through February 5, 2007. The total leases processed were 351. Total leases approved, 341. number of distinct permits, that is, number of permit holders involved in those leases, 459, and the total days at sea leased were 9,241. We have published, after discussing with the council and getting a request from the council, a proposed rule to implement collection of detailed information on the Atlantic hagfish fishery. That was published in the November. The comment period closed on December 1, and we're still awaiting PRA clearance from OMB on that, and so hope to be able to publish a final rule on that soon. The proposed rule to increase the weight used to measure net mesh 120 millimeters or greater to 8 kilograms. Again, another request from the council was published on September 26th. The comment period closed on October 26th. And we're currently working with the Coast Guard to determine an appropriate effective date on that. Final rule for the 2007 specifications and management measures for the Atlantic mackerel, squid, and butterfish fishery published on January 30th and will be effective on March 1st. I'm not even going to talk about summer flounder. We published the final bluefish quota specifications on January 31st. The specifications are effective March 2nd. We wanted to make you aware that we have also released a cooperative research guidebook, and I know there were some on the table here for council members. I'm hoping that there are a whole bunch out on the tables out in the back. Looks like this. It's to promote and facilitate cooperative research. The guide covers issues such as selecting the research topic, establishing partnerships, identifying sources of funding, and preparing grant proposals. We have quite a number of them for some unknown reason, so please take many as you can. If you want any more, let me know. and it's very well done. I think, you know, if everyone had a chance to look at it, I think it's a good guide, and hopefully it'll be helpful to the industry and everybody involved in the cooperative research process. Let's see. Paul had asked that during my report I respond to his letter on dogfish. And basically the request was given the action the Atlantic States Marine Fishery Commission has taken on dogfish, and what was implemented in federal waters for dogfish, which are different. Federal waters is still the 4 million pounds, 600-pound trip limit, what the commission approved for this year and has recently, at their meeting just last week, I think it was, extended for 2007, as well as a 6 million-pound quota and discretion to the states to allow them to set their trip limits. And so Paul had questions on the issue of monitoring and the discrepancy, how we'll be handling the discrepancy. We have for this year, we have, of course, been monitoring all the landings, and we have for this year already closed the fishery for 2007 for dogfish in federal waters. As far as I know, the states are monitoring to the 6 million-pound quota, which I believe has not been achieved yet, and presumably, though, they will close when they reach that. Since this is an open access fishery, we do have the issue of people being able to, once the federal fishery closes, give up their federal permit and fish in state waters under a state permit. So that's a fairly major loophole in this fishery. And so there are so the discrepancy between the two has certainly created some issues that we're looking at and trying to make some decisions on how to respond to. And the last thing I wanted to mention was the herring specifications. We published the proposed specifications on January 10th, and the comment period on that excuse me, closes on February 9th. We did adopt the council's recommendation on the herring specifications for 2007, adjusted the inshore quota in the herring fishery from the 50,000 proposed by the council for the 3 year. These are 3 year specifications now, multi-year specifications. Adjusted down to 445,000 metric tons for 2008-2009, with a corresponding increase in the Area 3 TAC of 5,000 metric tons. And we did this based on the SSC's earlier concerns about the ability to keep the quota on the inshore area high over the long term. I think the last time the SSC was asked to look at it, they commented that although the current strategy was a viable strategy in the short term, it certainly should consider decreases in the inshore component in the long term. That was completely consistent with the PDT recommendations, which also expressed concern about the inshore component. There is a strong retrospective pattern in this fishery, and of course the risk assessment that was done with the proposed herring specifications showed that at the 50,000 metric tons, there was only a it would only be marginally successful at achieving FMSY on this component. So that certainly suggested to us that we needed to be more conservative in the future. And in fact, one interpretation of the risk assessment that it was is that even the 45,000 may be too high. So given that it was multi-year specifications, we felt it was appropriate to start with the council's proposal and reduce for 2008-2009. Of course, if new information becomes available, the council would be able to revisit the specifications in 2008 or 2009 based on that new information. And again, these are just at the proposed phase, and the comments are due by February 9th on that. And that's all I have.
Questions for Pat? Council?
Bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Pat. I have a couple questions, actually. One on Heron. If my recollection hits me right, we recommended 50 for 1 year, for the following year, not for the term out. And the service is just saying the 45 for the following 2 years under what you just said, your concerns that were there. But the council recommendation was only for the first year, right? We didn't set 3 years back.
It was a little bit confusing because the opportunity to do multi-year specs was in Amendment 1. So when the council was taking action on the specifications, Amendment 1 hadn't yet been approved. You didn't actually have the authority to do multi-year specs, but what the specification package or what the vote was 1 year unless Amendment 1 was approved, in which case it would be multi-year, 3-year specs.
But that's what I get confused about, because my assumption was the 50 would have been for the 3-year specs under the assumption that Amendment 1 was coming. That's what I thought I voted on. Which brings me to the next question, where are we at with Amendment 1?
Well, of course, the decision on Amendment 1 has been made, and now we're waiting to publish the final rule, and it's still under development. You want to know what the decision was? Sorry.
I know what the decision was. That part I got. I just wondered when can we expect Amendment 1 to be in place?
Your guess is as good as mine. I mean, I'm hoping soon, but
that's why I just carry
it. It's out of our hands.
All right. Has anybody ever looked to where this other hole, the 42 fell in, Amendment 1 fell in, where this hole is?
A lot of holes.
John Nelson.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I got some cough drops, Pat, if you need them. Just on herring again, following up on Phil's questions, I think the intention of the council was to take a look at it next year and at the specs and see if there was any need to do anything different. And I think that's still probably the intent of the council. If this additional information, and I know we got a kind of a preview of it at the herring meeting to show where the risks were, and I think we tried to address it as best we could at that time. I assume we're going to get that type of presentation, if not more, at the next setting of or review of the specs. Is there an ability for the service to modify their specs for 08-09 if the council reviews it and suggests that 50 is the number it should stay at? Or conversely, if they say maybe it should be 40, some number different than the 45, is the service able to respond to that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the setting specifications for 3 years doesn't mean that they are set in stone for 3 years. In fact, they do include the review, which says that should the information warrant it, they'll be modified in year two and year three. But it does require going through the specification process again. But yes, if the information changes, the specifications can absolutely change.
Jim Rohl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Pat, my questions follow up on herring issue also, and I think a lot of the issues have been clarified. I'm a little concerned with this the discussion about multi-year specs as to the role of the service versus the council, not necessarily with herring because of the fact that we were in a position where we couldn't establish multi-year specs. I was hopeful that the same information that would be provided to the service would be provided to a council so that if there was some kind of a significant change during the halfway through or two-thirds way through a multi-year package, that adjustments would be made. But and that in fact, is still the way I interpret it to be. The council has the first opportunity to make a significant change, and if you didn't think it was warranted or you think something different was warranted, you could have the ability to do that. The issue at hand with us in Mid-Atlantic is this: if it becomes necessary or you make the determination that Area 1A needs to be reduced by 5,000 tons, you're automatically allocating it to Area 3, where the quota has never been achieved. What Mid-Atlantic would like you to consider is any deductions, if they're necessary, from Area 1A be put in a reserve, and so that it could be used if for some reason that the mackerel fishery has encounters of a significant herring, that there's a cushion in there. And if it's not utilized, then it could certainly be utilized in Area 3 because the succession of the seasons falls to where it wouldn't be detrimental. Now, the concern I'm reasonably sure you're going to raise is that the Area 2 has an inshore component, but it also has an offshore component. So just to make you aware, that is an issue that the industry is concerned with and Mid-Atlantic is concerned with. If there was an opportunity to create this reserve, if deductions are necessary, it might be in everybody's best interest. So that's one of the issues. Thank you.
Well, of course, unfortunately, the comment period closes before your meeting next week, but is the council going to be sending comments to that effect? Or someone should send comments to that effect, I guess, is my response.
You'll have them by the end of the day.
Dave Gethel.
Yeah. My favorite subject here, dogfish. One pest in charge of another. Is there any hope of the various agencies that manage dogfish coming to an agreement on a universal dogfish management plan? I think this is one of the things that frustrates fishermen incredibly, that They just lose hope for the entire management system when they see the same fish swimming in the same ocean and somebody draws a line in the chart that no fish can see, only humans can see, and says, over here you can catch X amount of pounds, and 50 feet on the other side of over here you can catch 600 or you can't catch any. And I just think we ought to have a universal policy on the management of dogfish so that we're all catching the same thing and that we don't have various lines between state and federal people and different states with different quotas. And I just think this is a hopeless mess at the moment, and I think I would urge everybody, both state and federal, to get together and agree on a universal management policy.
I would just comment that we thought we had one, on the federal side at least. We've had the same quota and the same trip limits for I don't know how many years now.
Anyone else on the council? Anyone in the audience? Maggie?
Good afternoon, Pat. I have a question which you may not have the answer for at hand, but I hope you could provide it sometime. In September, you published a proposed rule to change the way that the trawl twine and the tops of the scallop dredges are measured. And I was wondering if you could tell me what the status is of the final rule.
Yeah, I did actually mention that very early in the report, so you may have missed it. I said that the comment period closed on October 26th, and we're still working with the Coast Guard to try to come to agreement on an appropriate date to implement that.
I'm just looking for some kind of estimate of when you might think that date might be next week or next year.
Jim McPherson?
About the weights. We contracted out to have the specialized weights made. We ordered 85 of them. We haven't received them all yet. We're looking at a 1 May date for implementation. We want to wait because the until we get all the weights so we can pass them out to all the units so we can do it at one time. The weights have to be tested and calibrated and certified because there's so much riding on a catch seizure. So we want to make sure that's done properly. But we're expecting to have all the weights here by March, and we're going to and built in just a little bit of delay. And 1 May looks like a good date for us.
Dave Ellington.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dave Ellington from Cape Seafoods and Western Sea Fishing Company. I just want to be clear as to what I understood the council did recommend with regard to herring specifications. And I thought that the council did recommend that if Amendment 1 was in place, they would recommend 50,000 tonnes for Area 1A for each of the 3 years. And so that the National Marine Fisheries Service determined that did not agree with that recommendation. It wasn't just for 1 year by the council, it was for the 3 years.
That's right.
And just so that nobody's pulling any wool over anyone's eyes, you discussed the potential to have a review of the 2008 specifications sometime during this year, but is the council able to have a meeting to discuss 2008 specifications, given the priorities and given the concern over budget? Are we really looking at something that's not going to get a review?
Yeah, Dave, the review is going to be done. As you know, the council, as you just brought up, voted not to take up the herring above the line to work on this year. But we will bring the report to the council, and all I can tell you is depending upon what's in that report, the council may have a change of mind or heart. That's the best I can tell you right now.
Oh, no, that's good news. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And that will presumably be in June or July. Okay, thanks.
Yep. Anyone else in the audience? Okay. Thank you, Pat. NOAA General Counsel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have very little to report other than to update you on our two active lawsuits. We have one lawsuit filed by the Commonwealth of Massachusetts challenging the emergency stopgap rule and groundfish that was designed to provide measures on an interim basis until Framework 42 was implemented. We've filed a motion, a joint motion, to stay any further consideration of that lawsuit until the Framework 42 lawsuit, which was also filed by Commonwealth of Massachusetts with the state of New Hampshire challenging Framework 42, until that lawsuit is adjudicated. The government has filed its answer and administrative record in the Framework 42 challenge, and this month there's going to be a scheduling conference to establish the briefing schedule for that lawsuit. And that's all I have to report, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions for Gene? Yes, Jeff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Jeff Kalin for Ocean Spray Partnerships from Portland. Actually, I don't have a question to Gene. I had my hand up on the earlier discussion. Can I just have a second at the microphone on that? And I wanted to ask the regional director. I thought the Magnuson Act only allowed the agency to approve, disapprove, or partially approve an action by the council. And I don't understand how or on what authority. Maybe this is a good question for Gene. The agency can decide to set a specification differently than what the council had agreed on. I just don't know where you get the authority to do that, and I wondered if we could get an explanation for that.
Well, the specification process, as implemented in the regulations, allow for the regional administrator to adjust as she sees fit the recommendations from the council. It's built into the regulations.
All right. Well, I appreciate the fact we're going to have a review, because I think one of the critical things, yes, we have a retrospective bias in the model. We've talked about that for years. But the other one was the downturn in the surveys, the fall and the spring survey, in 1 year that was really very pivotal, I think, in creating the outcome. So what we understand is, in fact, the survey information in 06 plussed it up again. So we'll look forward to having that discussion later this summer. And I'm glad you're going to take time to do that. Thank you.
Any questions for Gene? No. Science Center.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Nancy Thompson, who some of you may have not met yet, was planning to be here today. She's our new science director who has replaced John Borman. But at the last moment, she had a conflict and couldn't attend. So we're honored or stuck with Frank Almeida once again, who's in the audience. We can be grateful to Frank for being willing to fill in at the last moment. Getting on to some survey and vessel information, the winter bottom trawl survey will start on February the 5th. News regarding the Bigelow. The Bigelow is scheduled to steam from Virginia to Rhode Island, which will be its where it will be docked for surveys, et cetera. It's scheduled to arrive in Rhode Island around the end of February. The Albatross, as you know, which is the vessel that we've had for some time. The operations of the Albatross have been extended through the fall of 2008, so that we'll have a full year of having the two vessels to do calibration studies. And we expect to do the first calibration experiments between the two vessels in the fall of 2007. There, in Woods Hole, there have been some working group meetings, mostly people who are involved with the ecosystem survey branch and the population dynamics branch, and they've been actively talking somewhat informally about the sorts of calibration studies that experimental design and so forth that they will use when they get both vessels. So even though we don't have the Bigelow, we've already started actively talking about what to do with it once we get it. regarding stock assessment, we've just completed a SAWSARC number 44, and I'll be reviewing the results of that stock assessment on Thursday. And I'll be talking about the results for ocean quahogs, the Northeast skate complex, and Atlantic surf clam. The next SARC that's scheduled is for June of 2007, and on the agenda are northern shrimp and Atlantic sea scallop. And we also have black sea bass on the agenda, although there will be some discussions, and that may not be on the final agenda for the upcoming SARC. That might be handled differently. There are a number of other meetings that the center is actively involved with, all coming up this spring, and many of which are around May and June. There are such things as there's an ICES assessment methods working group in March. Vessel calibration work is underway. There's the data pour workshop, which has been mentioned already. Due to our heavy schedule in June, we're thinking that the data pour working group will meet a couple of times, probably in July. There's also a track coming up for groundfish. And then, of course, we're planning for the GARM, first GARM meeting on data methods will take place in October of 2007. Now, although we just did a SARC and with the skates, the New England Council requested that we update the skate stock status using the fall survey from 2006. So the SARC report, which I'll be giving to you on Thursday, only includes data through the spring of 2006. And when we updated the information for the skates using the 2006 survey, we forwarded that information to Pat Kirkle and then shortly thereafter to Paul Howard. So you have the information. At some point, maybe during my presentation, I'll point out one or two differences between the information that's in the SARC report and the latest information from including the most recent survey. Okay. That concludes my report, and I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thanks, Jim. Any questions for Jim? Good report, Jim. Paul.
Jim, we're in the process of developing a whiting amendment and a skate amendment for two overfish, as we'll find out, two overfish stocks of skates. And by having the data pool workshop in July, it severely sets us back with the development of whiting amendment and the skate amendments. Severely. Is there any way of moving that up?
Well, I can't give you a definitive answer. I will discuss it when I get back. We were aware of the comment that you were that this issue, and thought about how busy we are, and the discussions that I heard at the center were that June was just so busy that it didn't seem to be feasible. But I'm certainly willing to take the message back and open it up for discussion.
Any other questions? Okay. I'll give a brief report on the Mid-Atlantic Council meeting. I attended the meeting in December. It happened right after Congress passed the Magnuson Act. The first day and a half of discussions down at that meeting focused on fluke. And Senator Schumer made an appearance at the meeting to give the Mid-Atlantic Council an update on the specific provisions within the Magnuson Act that dealt with Fluke. That's about all I'll say on that point. The council also passed Framework 1 to the surf clam and ocean quahog fishery management plan that required VMS to be effective May 1, 2007 with respect to the Maine quahog limited access permit. They were given an additional one-year grace period to install VMS. The Mid-Atlantic Council also approved Framework 4 to the joint FMP monkfish plan, and they also approved the range of essential fish habitat designations to be included in the habitat omnibus. They took no action on dogfish. It remained status quo. They did take action on the trawl survey panel recommendations. We have that on our agenda item in this meeting. They put on, there's a notice of intent to file an EIS for Amendment 11 to mackerel, I believe. The intent of that amendment, correct me if I'm wrong, Jim, is to scope for limited access in that fishery. Council also hosted two public hearings. One was for Amendment 16. Tom Neese and Rip Cunningham attended that, and also hosted a SBRM public hearing on Wednesday evening. Then they handed out two awards. One was posthumously to recognize Nelson Biedemann with what they call the Fisheries Achievement Award, and it was presented to his wife, Terry. The award was designed to recognize individuals and or entities that exhibit outstanding professionalism, diligence, and effort to protect living marine resources. The second award that they handed out was the first, I believe, the first ever Ricks E. Savage Award, and that went to Jimmy Rule. What the Ricks E. Savage Award was designed to do was to recognize a person who's added value to the MAFMC process and management goals through significant scientific, legislative enforcement, or management activities. Jimmy was recognized for, among other things, his enthusiastic, dedicated, and helpful attitude in assisting commercial fishermen. It was noted that he's gone out of his way to help fishery managers and scientists understand the intricacies and complexities of commercial fishing and the natural cycles of marine fish. Jimmy used his spare time to keep informed on fisheries issues worldwide, and he also monitored his regional fisheries and then requested or needed it. He would represent his regional fishermen as well. So thought I'd make the council aware of that as well. Any questions? Okay. U.S. Coast Guard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to introduce the First District Commander, Admiral Tim Sullivan. Admiral Sullivan will be giving the Coast Guard report today.
Mr. Chairman, good afternoon. I am very pleased and proud to be here to represent the Coast Guard. I wanted to introduce a little bit about my background, touch on a couple subjects that I think are very pertinent, and, again, look forward to having a chance to meet with the rest of the council members. I took command of the 1st Coast Guard District in July, and this is the first council meeting that I've been fortunate enough to attend. I have, however, had the opportunity to meet with several of the council's members, including John Pappalardo, as well as Pat Kirkle and Paul Howard. These meetings have provided me and the background that my staff gives me with a deep respect for the objectives of the council and also for its members. I'd like to thank each of you for the respective roles that you serve in. I realize it's not easy duty. Just a little bit of my background is I've been in the Coast Guard since 1971. I've had a number of both sea and shore commands. I'm very pleased and proud to be back in New England. I had the opportunity to be the first commanding officer of the Coast Guard Cutter Juniper, which was the first of its class in Newport, Rhode Island. I've had a chance to do operations and fisheries in both oceans, in both the far Pacific, out of Hawaii and in the Marshall Islands, and farther both east and west from there, as well as New England fisheries. I have been the a sector, or what we then called the group commander on 9/11 out in San Francisco. I was the on-scene commander when the TWA flight crashed here off of Manhattan a number of years ago. And have I'm also currently what they call a principal federal official for the federal government as nominated by the president, and I do that in the great state of Texas. The I'm a avid recreational fisherman. I enjoy many other hobbies and sports. I'm a father of four, three sons and a daughter. One of my sons is a Coast Guard officer stationed in Charleston, South Carolina, one of our cutters right now. Over the last 3 years, I've been very fortunate to have Captain Jim McPherson as attending each council meeting as my and my predecessor, Dave Pekoski's representative, as the chief of the enforcement branch. He, however, is moving up, at least I like to think of it that way, in transferring to Coast Guard headquarters in Washington, D.C., apparently irreplaceable. But we're very lucky to have Captain Joe McGinnis, who is already on board of my staff, and as I know, Mr. Chairman, I'm sure he will serve in an equally superb capacity. I'm going to speak on just a few things today. Briefly, I'd like to discuss recent Coast Guard operations in the 1st Coast Guard District, including fishing vessel safety. But mostly, I'd like to give you a brief on the Coast Guard efforts for the recent loss of the fishing vessels Lady of Grace and Lady Luck, in order to provide you with a better understanding of the Coast Guard's efforts during search and rescue cases. Before I start, I'd also like to specifically thank Councilmember Rodney Avila and others members of the fishing industry for their support, specifically on the Lady of Grace case. This was a great great background and great counsel. So, Rodney, thank you very much again for that help. The business of resource protection is always a delicate balance, in, at least in my mind, of effective presence, deterrence, and over-the-rail enforcement, as well as constructive interaction with the fishing fleet. With this in mind, the Coast Guard is committed to living marine resources enforcement in New England. Our commitment to at-sea fisheries enforcement extends from a desire to ensure the safety of the fishing fleet, create a level playing field for all fishermen, and create an environment conducive to rebuilding fish stocks to a sustainable level. I'd like to give you a little bit of an idea of a summary of a recent December operation. I think that's pretty pretty indicative of some of the operations that that we have run since I've been here, and I believe my predecessor has run. Prior to the holiday season, the 1st District conducted a joint enforcement operation with three focused objectives: maritime homeland security, commercial fishing vessel safety, and living marine resources enforcement. This operation coordinated the efforts of numerous federal, state, and local enforcement agencies. During the operation, more than 1,000 fishing vessels were contacted, 400 of which were boarded, and only 3 which resulted in catch seizures. I was very impressed with the high level of compliance throughout the industry. During this operation, and as it happens with every Coast Guard boarding, regardless of the season, safety is our and my primary concern, not only for our boarding teams, but also for the men and women working within the fishing fleet. This operation resulted in 6 fishery vessel safety termination for lack of life rafts, immersion suits, or firefighting equipment, as well as an additional 75 safety violations. We conduct these boardings to ensure the fishing fleet has the best safety tools available to them in times of distress. Compliance is up, as well as participation in the Dockside Commercial Fishing Vessel Safety Decal Program. I appreciate and commend the fishing fleet's dedication and commitment to compliance with these critical safety regulations. Unfortunately, nature will strike despite our best preventative actions. Therefore, I'd like to take a few minutes to brief the council on the audience and the audience on the Coast Guard's response to 2 recent loss of life cases that occurred in the past 10 days. These are the sinking of the fishing vessel Lady of Grace in Nantucket Sound and the sinking of the Lady Luck in the Gulf of Maine. My intent in both of these cases, Mr. Chairman, is to provide you with a timeline as well as provide some insight into the operations that the Coast Guard conducts for search and rescue operations. First, the fishing vessel Lady of Grace. I've got some slides that I think, and the old adage that the picture is worth 1,000 words will help you follow along in a little bit of the cases. The Coast Guard on the Lady of Grace was first notified at 0506 on Saturday, January 27th, that the fishing vessel Lady of Grace had not called in. Our staff conducted initial VHF FM broadcasts for a vessel in an effort to locate it, and they also began to acquire the vessel's last known position. By 0630, the New Bedford police were combing the harbor to verify whether the vessel was in port or not. And at 0800, with no positive results, VMS was used to provide a last reported position, and this was utilized as a commenced search point for the initial searches conducted by HU-25 aircraft and HH-60 helicopters out of Air Station Cape Cod. These aircraft were on scene at about 9:30 local time. This slide that you have in front of you now, Mr. Chairman, depicts the initial search patterns for the first two aircraft on scene that Saturday morning. The initial search was for a vessel. When a sheen was located, we shifted the search object to a raft as well as a person in the water. The next is a search for raft by the HU-25. These are our jet fixed-wing aircraft, the Guardians. And the next slide shows you two additional raft searches by the HU-25. This is actually searches 4 and 5 at this point. Next slide depicts all the other combined searches that were conducted on Saturday afternoon, which used a person in the water as a search object. Assets included a 47-foot Miller lifeboat from Station Brant Point, a 41-foot utility boat from Station Woods Hole, HH-60 aircraft, and an HU-25 from Air Station Cape Cod. These were searches 6 through 9. The next slide depicts Saturday evening searches, which used a raft as a search object. Assets involved were an HU-25, an HH-60 from Air Station Cape Cod, and a 110-foot patrol boat, the Coast Guard Cutter Bainbridge Islands. And again, these were searches 10 through 12. Next slide gets a bit crowded, but I think does a pretty good job of depicting the area covered with all Saturday searches. And again, this is one day's search. Rolling into Sunday morning, two aircraft and a utility boat conducted these three searches. These, at this point, were searches 13 through 15, and followed by these afternoon and evening searches that were adjusted for drift. That's obviously the effects of the environment that's out there. This gets you up to searches 16 through 18. Then on Monday morning, these were the last two searches conducted, searches 19 and 20. The final slide for this case depicts the total search effort. The search was suspended on Monday following more than 48 hours of active searching. Over the period, 20 individual search patterns were executed by 11 aircraft and one patrol boat, 7 motor lifeboats, 2 shore units, and local dive teams. One of the factors that went into the decision to suspend active searching was the Canadian Cold Water Survival Model, which in this case allowed a maximum survivability time of 15 hours based on water temperatures, physical characteristics of the individuals involved. The second case last week, of course, was the fishing vessel Lady Luck. On 1 February 2007, the Coast Guard received an unlocated EPIRB alert at 0202 local time for the fishing vessel Lady Luck. Command Center staff attempted to contact the vessel via phone as per standard procedure for unlocated EPIRBs with negative results, and a request was made through boat tracks to email the vessel. VHF FM broadcasts were also conducted, and all, of course, with no response from the vessel. At 0300, Air Station Cape Cod was directed to prepare the ready aircraft for launch. At 0318, the first composite position for the EPIRB was gained, providing an accurate position for distress. 0339, the Falcon aircraft was launched from Air Station Cape Cod with an estimated on-scene time of being there at 0415. And at 0430, the aircraft located the strobe on the EPIRB but could not find the fishing vessel. These next several slides will depict the search planning and effort devoted to this particular case. First is the composite EPIRB location at 0318. Followed initial Thursday morning search by an HH-65 Dolphin air station from Air Station Atlantic City, following location of the EPIRB strobe. That search was quickly followed by these three searches by two separate aircraft, and three additional mid-morning searches were then conducted by two helicopters, and we had asked for and received a U.S. Navy P-3 from Naval Air Station Brunswick, Maine. These next slides depict that early afternoon searches conducted by two U.S. Coast Guard aircraft, an 87-foot patrol boat, which is the Flying Fish, and a Canadian Coast Guard helicopter. In the late in the afternoon, four more aircraft searches were conducted, and they were joined by the 270-foot Coast Guard cutter Seneca. Evening searches by an HA-60 using night vision goggles and an HU-25 are depicted in this search. And again, continued evening searches by an HH-60 using night vision goggles and the cutter Seneca. First light searches on the 2nd of February by cutter Flying Fish stationed in South Portland in an HU-25 as well as an HH-60. We had a SL-DMB, which is an electronic ability to drift over the search period. This gives you an idea, and it's kind of hard to see it in the lower left-hand corner there, as far as how far that when that initial SLDMB was placed in by the first aircraft, how far that had drifted. So it gives you a pretty good idea as to we were searching in the right direction. That stays in the water the whole time and gives you, an idea as to what that particular object in the water, how far that's gone during that time period. Continued on the 2nd of February, mid-morning searches by cutter Seneca and Flying Fish, as well as now another Brunswick P3, and then followed by an afternoon HU-25 search. Finally, again, this final slide shows you a total search effort through through case suspension, encompassing more than 8,100 square nautical miles. The search was suspended on Friday night following more than 37 hours of active searching. Over this period, 27 individual search patterns were executed by 21 aircraft from the Coast Guard Air Stations Cape Cod, Atlantic City, and Elizabeth City, as well as a Navy P-3 from Brunswick and a Canadian helicopter, two Coast Guard cutters, and a motor lifeboat. The decision to suspend a search is an incredibly difficult decision to make. In these particular two cases, it was mine alone. Many factors are weighed when I make this decision, including Canadian cold water survival models. This model listed survivability times for each case at 15 hours for the Lady of Grace and 25 hours for Lady Luck, based on water temperature, physical characteristics of the individuals if they were wearing immersion suits. We are treating both of these cases, of course, very seriously. Investigations are being conducted for each, and upon conclusion of the investigations, I intend to share any findings and recommendations with you and, of course, the rest of the board. As many of you are fellow mariners, I don't need to remind you of the inherent dangers of life at sea. These tragic incidents quickly remind us that the sea gives us much in resources, and we have much to be thankful for because of that, she will also quickly take them away. Regardless of your role or position on this council, we each share a responsibility to look out for the safety and well-being of the men and women who earn their living on the Atlantic Ocean. Thank you again as individual council members for your selfless service and commitment to the council, and our resources, and, of course, our individual mariners. I would be happy to answer any questions from the council as you see fit, Mr. Chairman.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Admiral, for the informative presentation, and welcome back to New England. We look forward to working with you and Captain McGinnis, and want to wish Captain McPherson good luck in his new endeavors. I understand that one Landry to another, you're just like a ping-pong ball bouncing back and forth. So we look forward to working with you, and anything we can do to support your work, we'll do what we can. Are there any questions for the Admiral? Okay. Thank you, Admiral.
Mr. Chairman, again, thank you for your time and effort and for the rest of the council.
NIMS Enforcement.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. Andy Cohen sends his regrets that he's unable to make this meeting. My name is Todd Dubois. I'm the Deputy Special Agent in Charge for NOAA Fisheries Enforcement in the Northeast Region. Your written enforcement summary really outlines the entire report. I'll just highlight a few quick items and then offer the opportunity for anyone to ask questions of NOAA enforcement. During this past quarter, there were 15 significant violations which resulted in seizures. And in addition, there were NOVA assessments from law enforcement actions resulting in penalties assessed at approximately $513,000. Significant events this last quarter included investigation of a Rhode Island fisherman for fishing in the exclusive economic zone during a period when his federal fisheries permit had been sanctioned. That case did result in over 400 lobster traps being seized for illegally fishing in the EZ during that permit sanction period. Another New Bedford vessel was investigated for fishing within a closed area and was determined to be in the closed area. That case also involved subsequent interviews were determined there was interference and false statements made, and that's also being pursued at this time. NOAA agents, along with Maine Game Warden Service, investigated a marine mammal take involving seals. There was criminal convictions in that case for take of a harbor seal, attempted take of a harbor seal, as well as migratory bird violations, which were prosecuted by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And also the Maine Warden Service also applied criminal wildlife violations to that individual. He's serving time in Maine for those violations. NOAA participated in a multi-agency operation in the port of Gloucester, which resulted in 64 fishing vessel boardings, 11 federal dealer inspections, and 3 fish truck inspections during that period. This involved our federal partners, including the Coast Guard, as well as state partners, including Mass Environmental Police and other agencies. During that operation, 5 fishing vessels, 3 federal dealers, and 1 truck was found in possession of illegal fish or violations. In addition, in that operation, there were 5 arrests made by other partners within that. NOAA agents conducting investigation for interference and observer. Observer issues have been a focus for us this past quarter and continue to be. During 2006, we investigated 8 cases of interference or intimidation of an observer. NOAA also continued its border operations up on the Canadian border, focused on lobster enforcement, basically anything imported from Canada. We expanded to the port of Holton, Maine, as well as our normal location of Calais, Maine. During those operations, the first 5-day operation, 34 trucks were inspected and 19 violations were detected. During the second 5-day operation, just prior to Christmas, there were 54 trucks inspected coming into the United States, and 25 were detected to be in violation. In addition, working with the Canadian Department of Fisheries and Oceans, 1 truck outbound from Maine was also found with undersized lobster as well. NOAA agents are investigating vessels for not contacting the observer program as required prior to sailing. We've had a number of complaints in excess of 100 in the last quarter of 2006, which are under investigation and being followed up. And NOAA agents also involved in investigations of pinger use in areas where pingers are required. Just a reminder, since some of those are coming back into effect, working with our partners, both our state JEA partners and the Coast Guard, to enforce the pinger regulations as well. And a final note, NOAA agents and Massachusetts Environmental Police did have a recent case involving scrubbed lobster and egg-bearing lobster in New Bedford, and that case is being forwarded for prosecution as well. Those are kind of the highlights. I think the seizure actions and the NOVA assessments are all outlined in the written report, but I'd be glad to answer any questions that you may have.
Thanks, Todd. Any questions? Okay. Thank you. Our last report, ASMFC. John, do you have anything?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. let me just say the ASMFC meeting took place last week. I think it was January 29th through February 1st over in Alexandria, Virginia. I was not able to attend, and I would look to my colleagues from the states to see if they could fill in some of the activities that took place during last week. So maybe Dave or Mark might have something.
Must have been a fun meeting. Okay, well, if anything comes up over the next couple of days, we can address it under other business. We're going to take a 5-minute break. Okay, if everybody could take their seats. Okay. Extended that break a little to keep us on agenda. We're ahead of the game. So 245 agenda item is ATSI processing.